Okay, first of all, welcome everybody. It's I'm gonna, but most of you will be on mute, obviously. Rewire will not be. But if you have questions, obviously feel free to unmute as needed. I want to thank Rabbi Weil for I called him on Friday, asking if this could be a possibility, and he immediately said yes, which was very, very amazing of him. And I want to thank him for learning with us virtually. There's a lot of learning going on, and we're really privileged to have Rabbi Weil, the managing director of OU, has been our scholar in residence not that many years ago here in Chicago in our shul. So thank you again to Rabbi Weil and for everything that that you are doing on behalf of OU, and the entire community is benefiting from your leadership. Just want to thank you, and I want to take any more of your time, Mr. Rabbi Weil.
Rabbi Liebtag, thank you very much. Reasons I'll never forget the Shabbos with your shul. One of them was that was the remembered when the police came to the shul. That was the Pittsburgh shooting.
Right.
It was an infamous Shabbos. But the more positive component was your hospitality, the shul's hospitality. It's an honor to be with you. I'm going to start out with a simple question. This question, it just sometimes you get a little question, and like it all of a sudden it opens up a whole world. It's like, you know, you're digging, boom, oil comes, or you hit gold. That's one of these questions. It's a question that's bothersome to all of us. We, the Ashkenazim, the Ashkenazic community, we used to observe the same minug as the Sfardim. One was our mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. We started the beginning of the Sfira through Lag BaOmer. All Jews did that. And then there was a flip. We, the Ashkenazim, we changed it. Our mourning now starts Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and it goes 33 days until the Shlosha Shemei Hagbala. Why flip it in the middle? What happened? You don't see that where a whole community changes its minhag, especially when you had one unified minhag and then we flip it. And that little question, it opens up a world. And that's, hold that question. Just, we're going to come back to it much later. But that's one question to think about. Another question, just, I assume everyone knows the answer to this, but just to lay it out. Why is it that Jews observe a mourning and avelus period this time of year? It's not in the Torah. The Sfira in the Torah does not have a component of mourning. Of course, the answer that you all give me is, what generated that mourning? We mourn the loss of the students of Rabbi Akiva, the 24,000, the 12,000 chavrusas. Well, okay, why? Why them? They weren't the only ones who died when they died. They were, whether you go with our numbers from the introduction to the Medrash in Eicha, it's about 800,000 people were killed during that time, or whether you go to later Roman historians that claims it was between 500,000 and 600,000, they weren't the only ones. What are we mourning them for? And that's what we're going to get into and eventually come back to our original question. So to start, who is Rabbi Akiva? You know who he was? He was the man that unified Judaism. What do I mean by that? Historically, whenever there was an issue in Judaism, we had a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is the primary legislative body, the primary judicial body. So if there's an issue that comes up, let's take an issue that we've been dealing with the last 30 years. What's the definition of motherhood in Judaism? Is your mother the woman who provides the genetic material? Or is your mother the incubator, the one whose uterus that you matured in? Now, again, that question didn't exist till modern history. But today, in theory, I could have two mothers, the genetic provider and the incubator. Or maybe the incubator is the mother, or maybe the genetic provider is the mother. And it has huge ramifications. Because if the fetus that's incubating is a baby girl, and you define motherhood by the genetic provider, well, you have a Jewish woman in her late 30s or 40s, and the egg donor is a Lutheran woman from Oregon. Well, that baby is going to require a conversion. That baby can never date a Cohen or marry a Cohen. Huge ramifications. So what would happen if we as Jews were living in the time of the Sanhedrin? If we were in an ideal world, you know what would happen? the scholars that made the case that it's a genetic provider would give their proofs, would give their rationale, their logic, as would the other side. And, you know, the other scholars would be there, and they challenge each position. They debate it back and forth. And after hearing all the angles, all the sides, all the arguments, they would have a vote. That's called a Sanhedrin paskening halacha. Acharei harabim lahatos, you follow the majority. And that becomes Jewish law. That existed from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, that existed all the way through Herod. When Herod became the leader of Judea, and he was 41 years from 37 before the Common Era till 4 of the Common Era. You can do a lot of damage. You can destroy a lot in 41 years. He was one of the greatest builders and one of the greatest destroyers all at the same time. So what did Herod do? He was so threatened by the Jews, and he knew the Jews didn't like him. He's not a Jew. He was a Nabataean. He was an imposter to the throne. And he knew that the Jews didn't revere him, didn't consider him one of their own. And he murdered anyone who he was threatened by. It's very much like Joseph Stalin or Saddam Hussein. They kill anyone who gets too close. He had a brother-in-law, Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. And his brother-in-law was revered by the people because he was from the Maccabees. He was from the Hashmonaim. And you know, when they were there on the holidays in the base of Mikdash, and everyone revered the Kohen Gadol, and they despised Herod. So what does he do? It's the winter in Yerushalayim. Herod, as many of you know, had many palatial estates. But he had one in Yericho. Now in the winter, if you're in Chicago, to get out of the cold, you'll go to Florida, you'll go to Mexico, you'll go to Arizona, you'll go to Barbados, St. Barts, wherever it is that you go. Where did the Jews go to avoid that cold winter? Yericho, where it's always hot. And he invites the Kohen Gadol to join him. He says, look, before we sit down and eat, why not? We have a beautiful pool here. You could use the exercise. It's a way to bathe. Go for a swim, and then we'll sit down as family. While the Kohen Gadol is getting the exercise and bathing by using the pool, Herod's guards drowned him. Herod had the Kohen Gadol murdered. We know from the Gemara how many of the scholars he murdered. What did he do? He prohibited the Sanhedrin from legislating, and he prohibited the Sanhedrin from functioning in any powerful, any sense of autonomy, any sense of control, of governance. He forbade. He had no problem if the Sanhedrin said as a yeshiva, as a think tank, they weren't a threat to him. But they were a threat as a legislative body or as a judicial body. During those 41 years, that's the emergence of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Because until that time, if there's a debate, it goes for a vote. There were always debates, but it went to a vote, and there was one Torah, one halacha. What he did was he had the Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. I mean, I'll give an example. Today, how do we approach something economically? There are two schools of thought. You have the Keynesians, based out of Harvard University, going all the way back to John Maynard Keynes. And then you have the monetarists, University of Chicago, Milton Friedman. Two schools of thought of how to approach things economically. Well, you almost had two Torahs, the Beis Hillel and the Beis Shammai. From the later generations of Beis Hillel, the greatest was Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya. You see him all the time in the Mishnah and the Gemara. And from the later generations of Beis Shammai, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. They called him the great Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Those two scholars were Rabbi Akiva's primary Rebbeim. Rabbi Akiva learned from many people, but they were his primary Rebbeim. Who was Akiva ben Yosef? Who was Rabbi Akiva? He's the man who once again unified Judaism. Being the greatest student of Rabbi Yeshua, the greatest student of Rabbi Eliezer, he brought the Jewish world back together. He unified those two schools of thought into one Mesorah. And over 50 years of his life, you know, he lived a very long life. He didn't start studying until he was 40. He went to school literally learning how to read and write. He was very bright, but he was illiterate. And he became a student a few years later of these scholars. In over probably 4.5 decades, he developed 24,000 students. Now, we say that they were from Antipras ad Geva, in English, throughout the length and breadth of the state of Israel. That's where they lived. They were the next generation. They were the future of Judaism. He became the Baal HaMasorah, the master of the generation, being the recipient of the Masorah from his two great Rebbeim. He transfers this to this huge, massive number of scholars in every corner of Israel. So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara doesn't make this up. It's quoting something. It says they died of ascaria. Ascaria literally means diphtheria. It's a pulmonological disease. Tragically now, during COVID-19, we see the tragedy of what it means to someone who can't breathe, literally who dies to death from the inability to breathe. But that, Rabbi Soloveitchik said this in many of the commentaries on the Gemara. That's not what they died of. They didn't die of diphtheria. Samech, Chaf, Resh, Ascaria. In Aramaic, that also is another way of saying the sword. They were slaughtered. They were butchered. They were murdered in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Now let's just review. So we said who Rabbi Akiva was. Who is Bar Kokhba? He led a revolt against Rome because under Hadrian, really under the Roman proconsuls and governors of Judea, it was impossible. Not just because of the tax burden, that was impossible, but the way the Romans treated us, you couldn't live. And the Jews went to Rome. They went to the new emperor Hadrian, Andar Yavesh, or we say in English Hadrian. And he started to revoke some of those just draconian, oppressive policies. Well, the Roman proconsuls, the governors, they said, listen, you don't live with those Jews. You don't live in the Middle East. We have to live there. We have to manage, and we're managing it for you and for the Roman Senate. Who are you? With the Jews or with us? So he saw that he was going to lose his own people. And what did he do? Not only did he revoke all of the draconian measures that had been implemented, but he made it even worse. He didn't just re-implement them. He made it even more severe on the Jews. The Jews had no choice. They had to revolt. They couldn't survive under those conditions. And the revolt went so well, as all of you are familiar with under Bar Kokhba, that just to give you in numbers, 6.5 decades earlier, the war against Rome, or I should say the Roman war against the Jews, which started in the Golan Heights in 66, worked its way to Yerushalayim, which was destroyed in 70. The Beis Hamikdash was destroyed in 72, was the mass suicide in Masada. That Roman war required 4 Roman battalions. But Roman battalion was 54,000 soldiers. Bar Kokhba's revolt was so successful. They reconquered Jerusalem. They established a government. Many of you have Bar Kokhba coins. It required not 4, 9. 9 Roman battalions. You're just a crack Roman battalion, the most elite Roman battalion, which was in Great Britain. They had to ship them onto mainstream Europe. It took them throughout the European continent, through what today is Turkey, through what today is Syria, Lebanon. That's what it took to defeat Bar Kokhba. When the Romans defeated Bar Kokhba and the Jewish revolt, they didn't just say, hey, like Soldier Field, after the game, we shake hands and we trade jerseys. Oh, no. They went and they slaughtered. There was the worst genocide in Jewish history till the Shoah. Again, I'm quoting the Psichta, the introductory Midrashim to Eicha, 800,000 Jews. Wiped us out. We're talking about children, we're talking about elderly, men, women, young, old. If it was 800,000, then that's the majority of world Jewry. If you take the smaller number that the Roman historians looking back conjectured, that's a third of world Jewry. Before the Holocaust, there was never ever a greater tragedy. There was never a greater genocide or destruction of Jews than what happened in the aftermath of Bar Kokhba. I'm not referring to the soldiers. I'm referring to the innocent civilians. Rabbi Akiva's students, those 24,000, they were part of that number. And Judaism should have never survived because the whole Balei HaMasorah were wiped out. Rabbi Akiva was in excess of 100. He was a very old man, most likely over 100 years old. We're talking now in the 130s, 135 after this happened, something like that, 136. You know what it says? Instead of him dying as a depressed, broken man, just living the end of his life in a malaise, he went down south. It was, apparently that was not the battle area. And he went to Rav Lasenu Shebedarim, and he found five young men, outstanding young men, who were not killed. Rabbi Meir was the youngest of them and the greatest of them. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai of Lag BaOmer fame, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Elezer ben Shamua. Those five, he invested the last years of his life, and he started from zero, and he tried to convey the Masorah to them, and he worked with these young men. He and the one student, Rabbi Elezer ben Shamua, they were murdered. We read about him on Yom Kippur. We read about them on Tisha B'Av in the 21st Kippur. They were killed during the Hadrianic Decrees in 137, 138, 139. But in those few years, he gave everything he had to those students. And Judaism survived, even though Vegas would have never given you odds. Judaism survived for those five. And Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yossi, they produced, amongst others, this person we call Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He was a Davidic descendant. And he was able to record on every aspect of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the essential opinions. Most of the Mishnah is these five students. And what they had from their teacher, Rabbi Akiva, what they could gain from other scholars, what they had from previous generations. They rebuilt the Masorah when no one thought it would survive. Because after the genocide, you had these Hadrianic decrees, no public Jewish education. You couldn't transmit the Smicha and many other decrees. The Gezeirot against, in order to stop Judaism. And in defiance of all of that, it survived. Despite that Rabbi Akiva was murdered, it survived against all odds. What did they do in that next generation? Could you imagine Judaism if we had 24,000 students and not five? Could you imagine the richness of our Masorah? And they had Rabbi Akiva in the latter years of his life. They weren't with him for 3 or 4 or 5 decades. But they were able to save Judaism. What they did was they commemorated the destruction of the Masorah, the loss of the Masorah, the loss particularly of the Baalei HaMasorah, the masters of the tradition, the Baalei HaMasorah. And they instituted, according to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather, a mourning equivalent of what we call Yud Beis Chodesh, the last 11 months that we observe for a parent, that kind of mourning. And that's what they instituted. Now, just to continue, in the aftermath of that genocide, you had what we call Sheiris HaPleita. You had a remnant. You had survivors. I'll use an analogy. Look at the survivors after the Shoah. Most of them were in DP camps. Couldn't go back to Poland. You had the pogrom in Krakow, the pogrom in Kels. Couldn't go back to Lithuania. Jews were being killed there, even though no one survived Lithuania. But the 3.6% that survived couldn't go back to the Ukraine. So what did those survivors do? Think about Reb Tzvi Hirsch Mises, who came to Chicago. Think about some of the few Lithuanians who came to Chicago that survived. Outside of Chicago and South Africa, there are no Lithuanian Jews. Hungarian Jews go to LA. The few Polish or Galiciana Jews settled. Where'd they come? America, Palestine, and after 48 became Israel, Canada, Australia. Those who survived had to literally, they had to take what they had from Poland, from Germany, from Lithuania, from Slovakia, and they reestablished it here in our soil and in the Holy Land and in Australia and in Canada, a few cities, Montreal, Toronto. The survivors in the aftermath of the Roman genocide, the only place you could live was the north, the Galilee and the southern Golan Heights, because the heartland of the country was plowed over with the Romans imported thousands of tons of salt. You know, think about those of you who drink Flam or Castel. I couldn't imagine such a thing. After they plowed over those areas with salt, that land was infertile. It sat infertile for almost 1900 years. Jerusalem, they renamed Elia Capitolina. Judea, it was known as Yehuda in Latin, Judea. To slap the Jews in the face, the Romans looked at Jewish history. Now, they were not experts of Jewish history, but they looked at the Jewish Bible. And based upon the Bible, they thought the worst enemies the Jews ever had were the Pelishtim, the Philistines. We know the period of the Shoftim, we know the period of Shmuel. And what did they do? To slap us in the face, they renamed our land after the Pelishtim, Palestina. It was a capital offense to call Judea. Where are Jews going to live? The only place they could live is the north, the Galilees, the Golan Heights. But even there, under the Romans, it was impossible. It wasn't easy. Was it a little bit easier than it was pre-Bar Kokhba? Yes. Was that feasible? Not really, and I'll prove it to you. I'm giving you rough years. Between 150 and 225, in that 75-year range, between 147 to 220, you know, that 75-year range, the majority of the survivors, the majority of the children of survivors, just like they left Europe, they left Israel. Where did they go? To the Fertile Crescent. Today we call it Iraq. To Babylonia, to Bavel. All along the Euphrates River. All along the Tigris River. Primarily the Euphrates, but partially the Tigris. Jewish communities started popping up. Survivors started settling there. You know Pumpadisa. Pumpadisa, right? You ever hear Fallujah? When the British conquered Fallujah in the Persian Gulf War? That's Pumpadisa. Balad. What's Balad? Also on the Euphrates River. That's Sura, the yeshiva that Rav and Rav Huna were at. All of these communities, Mechuza, Narda, Masa Machasya, many, Narash, all these communities. And the Mesora that went from Rabbi Akiva through the five students, through their student, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, most of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's great students, the large majority of them, migrated to Bavel. In fact, many of them who already were born in Bavel came to study by him and went back because you couldn't live in northern Israel. And probably 85%, I can't give you an exact number, but this is a very fair guesstimation. Probably 85, maybe 88% of the Jews who survived, or those, they moved to Bavel. Because it was a good life there. The Mesora moved there. What I mean a good life, I don't mean it was the equivalent of America. I don't mean it was the equivalent of Canada. But in relative terms, it was as good a diaspora as we ever had. Far, far superior to the Roman-controlled northern Israel. I'll give you a couple of examples. First, we started under Iraqi control, Babylonian, the people who lived in Bavel, Parthians. But then the Sassanid dynasty, there were Zoroastrians, you know, Zubin Mehta, it's a Zoroastrian, that group. They conquered from Iraq, the Iranians, the Persian Iranians conquered from Iraq, and they kept the same system. The Jews were good for business. The Jews were loyal citizens. the Jews were good for international trade because they had connections with other Jews. So they allowed, just like the Babylonians did, meaning the Iraqis, the Persians who controlled Babylonia allowed us to have self-governance. We had this concept called the Reish Kalusa, the governor or the exilarch of the Jewish community. He and his team were responsible for the taxation of the Jews, setting up Bat Din, Jewish courts, Jewish self-governance. As long as they got their money from the Jews, they were very happy not to have to control the Jews, not to manage them, that there should be Jewish self-governance. And centuries later, in the 7th century, when the Islamic Revolution comes to Babylonia, to Iraq, they employed the exact same system. They kept everything the same as the Persians did before them, as the Babylonians did before them. So you had the Gaonim, these great rabbis. They were the heads of the schools in Pumbedisa, Fallujah. They were in Sura and Balad. And you had the Reish Galusa, the Jewish governor, the political, the executive of the Jews. And this goes on for at least 700 years. From the early 3rd century, the early 200s, this goes on until way into the late 900s, early 1000s. And unlike most of Jewish history, why did Jews leave Bavel? Not because of pogroms, not because of anti-Semitism. One of the few times in our history that we migrated, not because we were driven out or because we couldn't survive there. It's because after all that time, people slowly but surely discovered opportunities, business opportunities, economic opportunities, other places. But the Mesora that had almost been extinct survived in Bavel for close to 700 years. What were the two migrations out? The first were Jews that were traveling from Bavel into North Africa. There were many opportunities there. But the Moorish Muslims, the Berber Muslims, the Moorish Muslims, what they did was they crossed the Iberian Peninsula into Andalusia, into southern Spain. And they conquered southern Spain. And then they started moving up and conquering from the Christians, Castile, central Spain. The only part that in the end the Muslims never conquered was the northeastern corner, what we call Catalonia today, Catalonia, Aragon. That was always Christian. But the rest of the Iberian Peninsula was under Islamic control. And many Jews, we call them the Sephardic Jews. Many Jews traveled through North Africa into Spain, first into southern Spain, then into central Spain, then moved their way north. So you had this whole body called the Sfaradim, Sephardic Jewry. There was a second migration, again, for economic reasons, for business opportunities, that was not nearly as large from a population, from a demographic point of view, was not nearly as large. We call them the Ashkenazim, meaning us. What was their path? Initially, they started moving into the southern Italian port cities, Bari, Otranto, you know, on the southern tip of Italy facing the Mediterranean. Fantastic. These international traders, these Jewish businessmen, because they had connections back in Bavel, they had connections in the land of the Islamic communities that was along the trade route to India. They go into, not only they serve the role of bankers in Europe, but they serve the role of importers, of import-export. And they have credit from their fellow Jews who they know who may be related to them in other parts of the world. And the Jews settle there in southern Italy, and then they start to migrate along the west coast of Italy. Not the Adriatic side where, you know, Venice is. No, the other side, the Mediterranean side. Start moving north into Tuscany. And then from Tuscany, they start moving further north and crossing the Piedmont. The Piedmont is a mountain range. And the other side of the Piedmont is what you and I refer to as Germany. And they start moving into the German Rhineland. There's a famous Tuscan Italian family known as the Colonimus family. Colonimus is a Greek word that is the translation of shame tove. They had a great reputation. They were very pious, very learned. So even the colonimuses are moving into the German Rhineland. There's really two main areas that they start migrating into: northern France and southern Germany, southern and western Germany. Now, please understand this. There probably were not, at most, Rabbi Canifogel told me, at most 15,000 Jews in all of Germany. Obviously, there was no country Germany. Germany is a 19th century creation. It is different feudal lords. But what I'm referring to is the German Rhineland. At most 10 to 15,000. Those are called Ashkenazic Jews, because Ashkenaz is that part of Germany. And at most, there were probably 11 or 12,000 Jews in northern France. Not a lot of Jews. Many more Jews still in Bavel. Many more Jews in Spain. But they packed a punch. Qualitatively, it was incredible. Somehow, and I don't know who all of the individual Balei HaMasorah were, but the Masorah travels from the schools, the yeshivos in Bavel, it travels into Mainz, Germany. There are three great communities along the Rhine River. Spires, if your last name is Shapiro, you come from Spires, it's an English spire. Worms, or Misa, and Mainz, Magentia. In Mainz, you had in the 10th century, maybe the greatest Jew on earth. Maybe his peer was the Rif, but possibly the greatest Jew on earth. Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGola. He's not just called Rabbeinu Gershom. He's the one who enlightened the diaspora. He had a yeshiva in Mainz. And after he dies in the 11th century, his students continue the yeshiva in Mainz, and some of his students set up schools in Worms. Jews from all over the world came to the yeshiva in Mainz to study by Rabbeinu Gershom, came to Worms to study by his students. Jews came from England, from Spain, from Babylonia, came from France. The most famous from France that we know is this Wunderkind, this brilliant young man by the name of Shlomo, from a little town by the name of Troyes, T-R-O-Y-E-S. Troyes, if it had 200 families, that was a lot. They couldn't teach him in northern France. You have to send him to Mainz and Worms. And he spent 17 years studying first in Mainz and in Worms under the different students of Rabbeinu Gershom. But he wasn't the only one. And that's where the Masorah had moved. So let's just retrace before we develop this. You had it initially, the Sanhedrin. Then after Herod, it split up into two primary groups, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai. Rabbi Akiva once again unifies the Masorah, but his students are annihilated in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt during the genocide, the post-Bar Kokhba genocide. Then you have these five students at the end of his life. They're the ones who author the Mishnah. By the way, the commentary to the Chumash, what's called Medrash Halacha, the Torah's Kohanim is authored by Rabbi Yehuda, the Sifrei. In the Sifra, that's Rabbi Shimon on Bamidbar and Devarim. The Mishnah, Stam Mishnah, is Rabbi Meir, and his student is the editor, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Judaism survives through them. But because you can't live in Israel, the Roman tyranny is just overwhelming. The majority of the survivors move to Bavel, and the Masorah moves with them through the students of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rav and Shmuel and Rabbi Chia and Levi. And their students and their students for 700 years. And then it transfers to the German Rhineland. I'll just give you a simple example of something that you're all familiar with. In the year 1000 in Mainz, Rabbeinu Gershom has a convocation. He brings together he sends out messengers, all the scholars throughout Ashkenaz, throughout Germany, Austria, northern France. And they come up with a series of charamim, excommunications against a Jew who's a polygamist. We're not going to go into the reason of what the basis of that was. A Jew who will not divorce his wife. will not give her a get. Put him in cheirim. Or I take it back, what I said was wrong. A Jew who divorces his wife against her will. Who divorces her against her will, put him in cheirim. A Jew who reads the mail. You know, when they would send messengers, you're talking about very important data. It's business. You know, it's about that there's, you know, we need this spice or we need sugar or we need, you know, alcohol or we need this, whatever it may be. And I have a contract for it. Can you get me this much at this price? Well, if the messenger reads that, then he steals the contract. He finds out which Gentiles are buying it from the Jew and he brings it in. So there's a cheirim. Cheirim means, just give you a sense, can't invite that person for Shabbos, can't do business with that person, that person can't attend the minyan, that person doesn't get buried in a Jewish cemetery. They meant business. They wanted Jews to behave. Only Rabbeinu Gershon could pull that off. Only Rabbeinu Gershon could pull that off. He was the master of the Masorah. Maor HaGola, the one who enlightened the diaspora. Something happened, though. And the year is 1096. In Hebrew, we say tat nu. Tuf, tuf, nun, vav. 1096. So there was a French theologian by the name of Godfrey of Bouillon. Godfrey of Bouillon said, how can we self-respecting Christians tolerate the fact that the Holy Land and the Holy City is under the control of Muslim infidels? How can we tolerate that? And what does he do? Le croix, the crusade. We're going to go and we're going to liberate. We're going to emancipate. We're going to emancipate the Holy Land. Not too many Frenchmen were looking to leave their family to die of malaria or get killed, where no one would know what happened to them. They just weren't looking to do that. It didn't take off. As they say in Hollywood, take two. So what does he do? Get smart. He goes to the prisons. Anyone who fights Le Croix, number one, you keep the spoils. And he goes to all of the poor, the peasantry, who are born poor, die poor, their children will die poor because there's a caste system. No, anyone who conquers spoils, it belongs to them. Now you're talking, and even better, he went to the people in the prisons, and he said to the poor, anyone who participates in Le Croix, in the crusade, has a lichtige Gan Eden. They get a penthouse suite in heaven. If you're a medieval Christian, the average life expectancy in France at that time is about 32 years old. Gehenna in Gan Eden, or heaven and hell, they mean a lot. It's not America where we're living into our 90s, where we're doing well, where we have a home in the South, or we, you know, we're going to spend our golden years in Florida or Arizona. Very different there. So he gave him Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. It became big. Now, Rashi, and this is very important, Rashi's quite an old man at this time. Rashi dies in 1104. This is, we said, 1098. What's fascinating about Rashi, his hometown brought him back to France. They brought him back to France because he's the hometown boy. And after 17 years of studying in Mines and Worms, they wanted this great world-renowned scholar, this student of the students of Rabbeinu Gershom, back in France, in the Champagne region. By the way, Troyes, which is in the Champagne region, never ever produced, Rashi was not a vintner. That area never ever produced grapes. And we have historical records going all the way back. He knew a lot about grape production because it was other parts of the Champagne region. What he did for a living, we don't know. But he made a condition with him. I'll come back home with one condition. I can bring a cola. And he brought five great young students from Germany, from the German Rhineland, with him. Three of them became his sons-in-law. One of them is known as Rabbeinu Simcha. Who's Rabbeinu Simcha? the author of a work that we study till this day, it's called Machzor Vitri. What is Machzor Vitri? That's how we get the title Machzor. It was an analysis of all the laws of the holidays. Our observance of the holidays are predicated upon this work. So Rashi becomes the leader of Northern France. Remember, until that time, the Northern French sent the best and brightest to Germany, to Ashkenaz. Now they've got one of them coming back, Rashi, the hometown boy. What did he do? He had created, I'll come back to Godfrey of Bouillon in just a minute. He created, he was actually working on three editions. He was working on the third editing, the third rewrite of it. A kuntras. What's a kuntras? It's the notebook. You and I call it Rashi. We call it Rashi's commentary on the Gemara. But what he was doing was, and he had this incredible ability to write. What did he do? He wrote in a way where the axiom, the postulate, the principle was crunched into a few words. And then you and I, the student, we could deconstruct his few words. We could deconstruct it and recreate what? The whole discussion, the whole principle, the whole analysis, what was bothering him, what the question was, how he approached it. He had a brilliant ability to write in a succinct way, but he transmitted the Mesorah of mines and worms that came from Bavel, that came from Northern Israel, that came from Rebbe Akiva. It wasn't, yes, it was his words, but it wasn't his words. It was the what he learned from the Mesorah going all the way back, what he learned in worms and mines. Had he not been brought back to France, there's a famous phrase that actually comes out of the Gospels. It's called Ein Navi Be'iro. There's no such thing as a prophet in his own hometown. Meaning what? You could be the great rabbi. You could be the great scholar. You could be the prophet anywhere else. But in your own hometown, they remember you running around in diapers. They remember you as a kid with pimples on your face. They remember you on Simchas Torah as the one twisted into knots, everybody's talasim. But somehow, they brought him back. They were willing to bring him back because they knew the gold, the diamond they had. And because they did that, we'll see how Judaism survived. So the French Jews were extremely scared. Now that Godfrey of Bouillon had a mass of people that were heading towards the Middle East, every Jew knows the Christians view us as the worst infidels. Forget about the Muslim infidels. What about the Jewish infidels? We're the ones that they claim are guilty of deicide, not just possibly those Jews who were involved with Pontius Pilate. But every Jew in history that doesn't accept the carpenter of Nazareth as their salvation is guilty of deicide. And they were scared to death. Not only did they have fast days, and did they daven with sincerity, and did they try to pay off, you know, the various mayors of towns to have a lockdown when the crusade would come through. But the Jews in the German and the Austrian communities, those Jews of Ashkenaz, raised a fortune of money and sent it to France so they could use that money to pay for lockdowns, to pay off communities not to work. It's like, you know, like the PPP. It's like the bailout. So that way that the Crusaders couldn't come into the towns and the Jews would survive it. Two things happened. One is that the French Jews did survive. It was difficult. It wasn't pleasant. But we don't have mass slaughter. Later Crusades, Jews get affected in France, not the First Crusade. Something happened, though, that no one ever anticipated. Because in France, the Crusade was grass tops, was led by the church, by Godfrey of Bouillon, an archbishop. It was led by priests. In Germany, it was grassroots. It wasn't grass tops, it was grassroots. And it came, Peter the Hermit, the People's Crusade. And what they did was, they said exactly what the Jews feared. And no one expected a crusade in Germany. Why in the world we're going to schlep halfway across the globe? Let's start with the worst infidels. Let's start with those bankers, the ones who charge us the interest. Let's start with the Christ killers. in towns, villages, towns like Regensburg, but along the Rhine River. In May and June of 1096, they started going north. I apologize, I said it was 1098, I'm mistaken, it was 1096. They started going north first on the 23rd of Iyar, in May of 1096, Spires. Then later that month, Worms, a second attack on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, Worms annihilated. The attack on Rosh Chodesh Sivan killed all the Jews. The third of Sivan, they get to Mainz, annihilated. The yeshivas, the Balei HaMasor, great scholars, everyone, men, women, children. Just give you numbers. Around 5,000 people were killed in the First Crusade in Germany. Remember we said at most there were 15,000 Jews? More likely 11,000 Jews. Wiped out almost half. If you're very, very expansive, so then it wiped out a third. But let's assume it wiped out around half. What do you think it was like surviving those crusades? Most of Ashkenaz became Judenrein. What the Jews did, the survivors from Poland and Lithuania and Ukraine and Slovakia, they all left. That's what the German Jews did. Very few remained. And most of them now migrate south into France, into northern France. Rashi is an old man in 1096. He lives another 8 years. But what he does is he transmits the Masorah that he received to his sons-in-law and his young grandsons. His son-in-law, Meir, had three great boys. Two of them we're all familiar with. The greatest was Yaakov, Rabbeinu Tam. Probably after Rashi, the second greatest Ashkenazic Jew ever. Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. And they start throughout the eastern France, they start northeastern France, they start schools. The schools that we call them the schools of the Balei Tosafos. Ramu is Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson. Rashi has a great-grandson, the nephew of Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yitzchak in Dampier, in Orleans. And throughout Eastern, you've got these schools. And what do? When everyone else was annihilated except Rashi, now they start to rebuild the Masorah. It's no longer in Germany. The Masorah has moved to northern France. And they do everything they can for it to survive. That generation, the post First Crusade generation, they did a number of things. First thing they did, and that answers our initial question. They said the purpose of the Avelus of Svira is to loss, not to mourn the death of Jews. To mourn the death of Jews is Tisha B'Av. This is the mourning of the Masorah, the deprivation, the loss of the Masorah. That's what this is. What Judaism was and what we lost. Well, we're not just mourning what happened to the students of Rabbi Akiva. We lost in our lifetime. We lost the Balei HaMasorah, the Masorah of Judaism. They came from all over the world to Mainz. And we lost that. And these people in northern France and the survivors in southern Germany, they instituted this. We're not going to just commemorate the loss of the students of Rabbi Akiva. We're going to commemorate the loss of all of the Balei HaMasorah that were slaughtered, that were murdered, al kiddush shem shamayim, because they were rabbis, because they stood for Judaism, because they wouldn't accept the baptism. When did they die? The latter part of Svira. And that's why instead of the first 33 days, it's the 33 days of Iyar and Sivan, right up till the Shlosh Shemei HaKvava. Second thing they did, Av HaRachamim, they instituted this incredible prayer, powerful, powerful prayer for those who died al Kiddush Hashem, those who sacrificed in their life for the Masorah and then were murdered because of it. Twice a year it was instituted. You go to a German shul, a real Ashkenazic shul, like Breuer's, it said twice a year, the Shabbos before Shavuos, because that week, worms and minds were annihilated. And the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av. I know the modern word for it is Shabbat Chazon, right? Because Chazon Yishayahu, it's the Haftorah that's read, Shabbat Chazon. The Ashkenazim refer to it as the Shvart Shabbos, the Black Sabbath. Before Ozzy Osbourne, we had the Black Sabbath. That's what they call it. Twice a year, on the Black Sabbath, and on the Shabbos before Shavuos, you say Avarachim. So why do you and I say it all the time? Open article sitter, any sitter says, because I'll tell you what happened. In the aftermath of the Black Death of the bubonic plague, in the second half of the 14th century, when the Jews could no longer live in Central Europe because of the terrible anti-Semitism, they started moving. Some of them moved to Spain. That's why you have a Jew by the last name of Ashkenazi. How can you have a Sephardic Jew with the last name German? Because some of them migrated there in the aftermath of the Black Death. Some of them moved to northern Italy. They started establishing Ashkenazi communities in northern Italy. The Maharik, famous of them. Others, Mari Mintz. But most Jews, they started moving into Galicia, Western Galicia. The German Jewish family, the Isserlands, who produced the Ramah, his grandparents moved in there. Started moving into Poland proper, further east into Lita. What happens? Once Ashkenaz resettles itself in Poland, there's a pogrom here. Throughout the centuries, there's a tragedy here. They started saying Avarachimim this Shabbos. They started saying Avarachimim because of that tragedy this Shabbos. Before you know it, you're saying it as much as you're not saying it. You're saying it more than you're not saying it. So what they did was the Polish minhag is that, and listen to me on this one, wherever there's a kiyum tachanun, meaning what? If today weren't Shabbos, if today were a weekday, would we say tachanun? Yes. Oh, then if today's Shabbos, instead of saying Tachanun, we're saying Avarachim. If this Shabbos is Shabbos Chanukah or Shabbos Chol Hamoed Pesach, well, if it was a weekday on Chanukah or Chol Hamoed Pesach, you wouldn't say Tachanun. Then that Shabbos, there's no Avarachim. So Avarachim is said what? It's a Kiyum Tachanun. But the original minute was twice a year. What else did they do? They compose some of the most tragic kinos. The two famous ones are the 22nd and 25th of the kinos that we say, where it describes what happened on what date in each town, where it describes what they did to us, where it describes what they did to our Sifrei Torah. And they write in the 25th kino, V'chi ein lahosif moed shever v'tavera. You can't mosif, right, from Musaf. You can't add a moed, a designated time, to commemorate the destruction. Meaning, we wanted to set up a fast day. We wanted to establish a fast day, a day of mourning for all the Jews in Sivan. But you can't, because all tragedy stems from Churban Beis HaMikdash. When Hashem removed that intense providential relationship on the afternoon of the 9th of Av, when General Titus, the Roman general, came into the Holy of Holies with the woman of ill repute and engages in fornication in the Holy of Holies and slashes the parochas and uses that as bedding, that's Sivan Hashchina. And all tragedy stems from the lack of that intense providential manifestation where we don't perceive God to the same degree that we did before. And therefore, we can't create a second day of mourning. Tisha B'Av is the day of mourning. And we will commemorate the destruction of German Jewry on that day. However, for the loss of the Masorah, not the intense mourning, where we go back and relive the tragedies like we do on Tisha B'Av. Every Jew is at the funeral. Every Jew is an Onan. We're back in Shiva. During the time that it happened, we're not going to do that. But we are going to have a lighter period of mourning. And we'll do what? We'll acknowledge the loss of the Baal HaMasorah and the destruction, the deprivation of not having that Masorah. That's the basis. One small thing. The Jews of Worms instituted a fast. That fast on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, when it was annihilated, the Worms Jewish community observed that fast from post the First Crusade until they were deported to Auschwitz in 1942. So throughout the history of Worms, when they would import Polish rabbis in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, the rabbi would come, big Talmud Chacham. He said, you can't fast on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. In the Shulchan Aruch, it's explicit. You're not allowed to fast on Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, if anything, you have a suda, you have a meal. You can't fast. And they'd say to him, listen, that's what the last Polish import told us, the last rabbi. And you know what we told him? If you don't like it, we've been doing this since the beginning of the 12th century. If you don't like it, go back to Poland. This is Minhag Avoseinu. In fact, if the fast would fall on a Friday, so that you're not going to, you can't ruin your own Shabbos. You can't walk into Shabbos start. So they would have an early mincha service Friday afternoon. They would daven like a tannis, like you would on a fast day. And they would break their fast after the early mincha in order not to walk into Shabbos in a ravaged state. These are the kind of things they did. Okay? I want to bring it full circle. Because we talked about the first institution, the first Minhagei Avelus that were established to commemorate the loss of the post-Bar Kokhba genocide, loss of the students of Rabbi Akiva, 24,000 masters, scholars. And then we brought them, traveled through the Masorah all the way through northern Israel, through Bavel, through Italy, into the German Rhineland. And then what happened in the generation afterwards, the survivors in northern France, and how they changed Minhag Ashkenaz. So we answered our question. But if I could speak to you and I, our generation, I think this Minhag, in what we studied, discussed in this brief hour, speaks particularly to our generation. In the aftermath of the Holocaust, of the Shoah, almost everyone was wiped out. I mentioned that only 3.6% of those who were living in Lithuania survived. The great yeshivas of White Russia, of Belarus, and Lithuania, we call Litvisha Jewry. That was the basis of the Masorah. The Baal HaMasorah were in these places, wiped out. We had a few, the phrase, Ud Mutzal Mi'esh, a few embers saved from the fire. Rabbi Soloveitchik was from Belarus. Rav Aaron Cutler from Belarus. Rav Hutner. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky from Lita, from Lithuania. Rav Moshe Feinstein from Belarus. Pruzhan. And then in Israel, we had two. The Brisker Rav. Brisk is Belarus. And the Chazon Ish from Lithuania, from Vilna. Those two in Israel, and the five in America, they were the equivalent of the five students of Rabbi Akiva. They were the equivalent of Rashi and his base medrash in Twa. And through them, Judaism survived. I'll give you one little anecdote. Many of you are familiar with the Lower East Side. That's where the Jews settled. And the Lower East Side, it's no longer true today because today hipsters live on the Lower East Side. It's really a sort of a chic little neighborhood. But today, if you want to get Svarim, go to Lakewood, go to Borough Park. In those days, all the Judaica was on the Lower East Side because that's where the Jews were. And they primarily earned their living from selling wine and grape juice, selling candles, Yahrzeit candles and Shabbos candles. And you know what they would sell to the Reform and Conservative Talmud Torahs and Sunday schools? Remember the Machberet? They would sell those little books that you would study from. That's what they published and sold. They didn't make much of a living selling Sifrei Kodesh. It's pre-art scroll. It's pre-Jews who had any interest. So there's a story. A Jewish survivor comes. He comes into one of these stores on the Lower East Side. You know, you can smell the pickles, the garlic wafting in the air from the Gus's Pickles down the block. And he says, I'd like to buy a Kitzos HaChoshen. The Kitzos HaChoshen is this great work on financial law. It was written by Rabbi Arya Heller HaKohen. It was a great work. Classic on Jewish financial law. The guy goes into the back. He starts blowing off all the dust. And he says to him in Yiddish, this will be the last Kitzos HaChoshen ever sold in America. Meaning, Vegas wouldn't give you odds that people were going to study works like that. Not in America. If I tell you today, there's probably 300 Kitzos HaChoshens bought every month in America. It's incredible. In America and Israel today, there's a new commentary on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah written every week. Can you imagine, thanks to Art Scroll, thanks to the students of these five great Talmidei Chachamim, the impact Rabbi Soloveitchik had, the impact Rabbi Moshe had, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Rav Ruderman, I left him out, Rav Ruderman in Ner Yisrael, a student of Slobodka, the great school in the suburb of Kovna in Lithuania. Who could have imagined that we'd have 7,000 people learning in Lakewood, that you'd have over 1,200 boys in YU, that you have 400, 500 in Ner Yisrael in Baltimore, not to mention all the other yeshivas that exist throughout America. How many tens of thousands going to Jewish schools, not going to public school, going to Jewish schools? How many people learning Daf Yomi every day? Could imagine such a thing. No one could dream of such a thing. That Art Scroll could produce the works it produces, the classics, and that there's an audience and a population that wants to read the classics. Unfathomable. That was because of those unique individuals. And we are their students. We are the students that have, I don't want to say a chip on our shoulder, because that's maybe the wrong way of saying it, but have a challenge, have a yoke, a burden, in a positive way, a burden. And that is not to allow what was annihilated in Europe to die. Not to allow the Masorah of Poland, of Hungary, hundreds of amazing schools in Hungary, Romania, Poland, all of them wiped out. One rabbi in 1,000, Reb Zvi Hirsch Meisel, settles in Chicago. Everyone else wiped out. We have a challenge. Like they did in northern Israel, like the Jews in northern France did after Mainz and Worms were wiped out, to rebuild and reestablish the Masorah. And to rebuild it and build a better tomorrow, a better Jewish people. A Jewish people that will take the richness, the sophistication, the thoughtfulness, the charm of everything we had in Europe and transplant it and produce it as an American version, as an Israeli version. And thank God, against all odds, there are more people learning Torah today than we ever had before. It's incredible. And it defies all odds. But we have to make sure that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, that they are stronger Jews than we are. And that the beauty, the substance, the wealth, the richness of our tradition, in all of its sophistication, in all of its tapestry, continues. That's the role of our generation. And you see it in Israel. We're not the most, in terms of Torah, we're not the most creative generation. Although I will tell you, when it comes to technological issues, we have no choice. Our Gedolim, our Poskim, have to deal with technological issues because this is groundbreaking work, and we have to respond to it halachically. But look at the production. Take Musar Rav Kook. Look at all of the what Hebrew University did, gathering all of the Kisvei Yad, the manuscripts. And now we're coming out with critical editions of Rishonim that we never realized we had. I don't just mean the Me'iri. The Me'iri is amazing. People didn't study it for hundreds of years. Now they study it. Everyone has it in their house. But many, many others. In modern times, these commentaries on the Chumash of the Balei Tosfos that hadn't been studied for hundreds of years. We took whatever manuscripts survived, and you've got Talmidei Chachamim working on them. Musar Rav Kook started it. But Machon Yerushalayim, it's an incredible thing. Incredible. That's why this period of mourning speaks to us. Their death should not be for naught. Their legacy, we have to recreate and rebuild. So that that eternal chain of the Masorah is never, ever severed, never, ever ceases. That is the story of why we changed the Minhag in Ashkenaz. And it's not just their story. And it's not just the story of the students of Rabbi Akiva. It's our story. It's our generation. It's our story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Weil. That was tremendous. I'm getting a lot of texts as this was going on about how much people have enjoyed history and everything. So I want to thank everyone for joining, and especially a big thank you to Rabbi Weil for giving up his time. We'll post it on Torah later. I'll send you a copy.
Thank you.